Hi, I'm Rob Grizz and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Claire Humphreys. Claire, thank you very much for inviting me into your home. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born in 1946 and I was born in Epworth Hospital. Private hospital then, but it wasn't as posh, of course, as it is now. But I've always been very proud to feel that I was born in Richmond, because that's real Melbourne.
That's real Melbourne, yes. Yeah. Claire, what would be your earliest memory of life then?
Well, my grandparents had an apple tree in the backyard, and I said to my grandmother years later, what happened to the swing in the tree? And she said, there wasn't a swing in the tree, it was your bassinet. And I was amazed to think that that was my earliest memory of, because the tree had been chopped down.
Right.
And what happened to the tree and the swing, and it was... It was the bassinet, so that's my earliest memory.
You mentioned your grandmother. Did she play a part in your early life then?
Oh, yeah, she played an enormous part. She was my mum, really. My mother and father were divorced when I was two, so I was given to my nan, and she brought me up with all of the love in the world, and I was very close to her. Yes, yeah, so she was my proper mum, really, because my mum used to visit on fortnightly Thursday nights, payday or whatever it was, and that was all I really saw of my mum, but my nan was my real mum.
So you never had a chance really to form any sort of relationship with your biological mum?
Well, I sort of did, but we didn't really get on. There's a saying, you know, that children, grandparents and grandchildren form a common bond because they have a common enemy. And I think looking back, you know, that was the business. You know, I was... My grandmother was very good to my mother, like by taking me on, and she wanted me to have as good a life as possible, because mm-hmm. my mum wasn't particularly maternal, and so my nan saw the need and she took me on, and it must have been hard for her because she was sort of middle-aged by then, and you know, it's hard to bring up a very lively little girl when you're menopausal, but you know, she did a great job, and yes, I wasn't too close to my mum. She was sort of the pretty lady who visited that smelt of tobacco and perfume, and she had long red nails and she wore corsages, and she was a pretty lady who, when she went to balls, she brought me balloons, but that was our relationship, really.
Yeah. So what sort of woman was your grandmother when you think back about her?
Well, she came from Yorkshire. Her father was a master builder, and they came out here early last century, and he was building churches. They travelled with governesses. There were four of them. They're all buried in Melbourne General Cemetery now. She grew up in Melbourne, but she was a lady, and she married my granddad. My great grandfather, he lost all the money building the churches in Sydney. Something happened in Sydney, and he built a lot of the churches, and he lost all his money in that. So then they were reduced circumstances. But my nan was still a lady, because you could tell by the way she behaved and the things that she taught me. And they sent me to a private school because they were not wanting the state school children to make fun of me because my parents were divorced, because in the 50s that was outrageously unusual.
Yes.
And so I was protected by that. But then in actual fact, by going to a private school, I was victimised rather more, really, because I stood out amongst those kids as well. So... You know, they were hard times, but she was a very ladylike lady.
What about your grandfather?
Granddad, well, she always said to me that she married beneath her station. So Granddad was a blacksmith, and they'd met in the church, and he was a lovely man too, very loving and very kind, and a very good grandfather to me. I mean, he used to take me on journeys to the end of the train lines on weekends to give Nan a break from me, and I'd see all of Melbourne that way. And I remember one thing I remember most clearly was Pentridge. It was so dreadful. He'd take me to that railway station, we'd get out and we'd look at the prison and we'd look at the guards, and it just put the fear of God in me that there was a prisoner, there was a prison there and there was all these guards. It was terrifying. And he'd take me to Hurst Bridge and he'd take me to all these different places, so just to get me out of Nan's hair because I was a live wire.
What do you remember about the house you were living in?
Well, it was in Northcote and it was a little darling house, two bedroom, just a little weatherboard, single fronted house. Granddad bought it before he got married, so they're engaged forever. And so they always had a roof over their head, and during the Depression, Nan was always pleased to say that she was able to, she was a dressmaker, and she was able to save them because Granddad couldn't get work in the 30s, and he was riding around with my mum on his bicycle handles looking for work all the time. And so they had it tough, but because Nan could sew, she was able to keep the family together.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Not from my mother and father, but my father had four wives and quite a few in between children. He was a bit of a lad, and he was a philatelist, and he owned a philately business, stamp business in the... He rented a Burke's Arcade. I don't know if you can remember Burke's Arcade, but it was like the old Coles picture book type of arcade,
right.
You know.
Yep.
And it was up in Burke Street on the hill. And he rented the whole arcade, and he was a businessman. He rented it out to all these people like boutique owners. And this was before the swinging 60s, so it was classic stuff like bookshops, pottery shops, you know, cutlery, whatever.
Yes.
And fancy clothing. And, of course, he occupied the whole ground floor with his stamp collection. And then one weekend, he was a good businessman. One Saturday afternoon, because the shops closed at 12 o'clock on Saturdays in those days, the very early 60s, and there was a mysterious fire. Burke's Arcade burned down, and they call them entrepreneurs these days, but I think my father was rather responsible there.
Oh.
And he got £1 million insurance, and he was only 40, so he was able to retire on Norfolk Island soon after that, I guess in the next couple of years, so... That's what happened there.
So he sounds like he was a bit of a lad.
Oh, a bit of a lad. I mean, you know, he was a crook, but, you know, they're called entrepreneurs these
days.
Yes, they
are called entrepreneurs. You're quite right.
And so anyway, that was always a secret in the family, but I'm never ever sure if it was absolutely true. But
because these things take on a life of their own,
don't
they?
Of course they do, and people talk, so who knows. But that's the story. And he had 28 kids, and I was the first one.
28.
Yeah, with all the wives and the ones in between. He never seemed to last long with the wives. It was the ones in between he seemed to last longer with. One of those poor women had seven children to him. And anyway, he retired with the last one, who was the same age as me, would you believe, to Norfolk Island. I think they had two children. And that's all I knew about that. I know he died in the early 90s.
Right. So without any brothers and sisters... Who did you play with as you grew up? Did you have some friends around
you?
Well,
it was in those days in Melbourne. I mean, I guess everyone's got a story about their childhood in Melbourne, but the Catholic kids weren't allowed to play with the Protestant kids.
No.
It was like racism.
Yes.
And I was a Protestant kid, you know, Church of England, and, you know, Catholics didn't get divorced. So the Catholic kids weren't allowed to play with me. So I used to play with the odd Protestant kid, because they were the terms like proddy dogs.
That's right.
You know those songs? And so I played with the other kids, and I used to like old ladies for some reason. I'd go into all the different houses and talk to the old ladies, and because my nan was sort of like an old lady to me, and so I'd go wandering around them. So they were the sort of kids, but I remember I was very independent in spirit, and my grandmother was very religious, and they'd met in the Brethren Church, my nan and granddad. And so they used to read the Bible around the fire at night, and in that little house in Northcote. I didn't have any chalk and I wanted to draw. I knew I wanted to be an artist from when I was a little girl. It was either an artist or a fairy queen, but then as the time went by, it became an artist.
Yeah, well, fairy queens is a little hard to get into the industry, isn't it?
It is very, nothing in the job searches. And so I discovered that dog poo went white in the sun. So I didn't have any chalk, so I thought, oh, and I started playing with it and I realised that you could draw with it on the pavement. So I started drawing, you know, Moses parting the Red Sea, and of course my mind was full of Bible stories because that's what I was learning at home, and I had to go to Sunday school twice on Sundays, for God's sake, can you believe it? And I went to a Church of England girls' school, and you had to stand up doing divinity five times a day with your hand behind you, recite from the Bible. I mean, you know, I was pumped. I was pumped as much as a Catholic child would have been in those days, because religion was big deal. You know, every family had some religious, you know, belief system that ran the home. Anyway, my grandmother caught me with this dog poo, and all the other kids were standing around because there were kids that, you know, me with the dog poo, it was noticeable. So they came out and they were laughing and saying, "That's terrible." And my grandmother came out and saw it, and she brought me inside, and the next thing I had chalk and a blackboard. I never ever got to have that experience again, but it was pretty good while I had it.
Sure.
Because it was expansive, all the flagstones.
Yeah, yeah. We keep coming back to the kids at school. What was the school experience like for you in primary school?
Well, apart from the fact that I was from a divorced family, the school was run by three old ladies called the Everard Sisters, Clarice, Matron and Evelyn, and they taught us. There were only 120 kids in the school, and it was in Northcote, up next to the Epiphany Church. You know the Epiphany Church on the hill there in Northcote, near the town hall? In James Street, like the Queen came along there in 1953, and we put flowers, we put floral carpet on the ground for her, and I remember seeing her when I was seven and looking at her thinking she was the most beautiful lady I've ever seen, and I think she still is the most beautiful lady I've ever seen, because she was just perfect, smiling at me. And so it went from kindergarten to matriculation. So I left there when I'd finished primary school, and there was a lot of bullying went on. There was a lot of new kids coming. The Greek and Italian kids were coming in.
Yes.
And my grandparents, my grandmother was, you know, Yorkshire lady, and they didn't trust, like they were xenophobic. They didn't trust, even though they'd grown up here, they didn't trust any outsiders. So we only had, you know, white Australians, you know, in the house. And when the Greeks and Italians were around, and the boys were so good looking, you couldn't help but looking at them because they were beautiful. And my grandmother said, "Don't go near them, don't go near them. They'd stick a knife in you as sure as look at you." And so the girls were in the school, of course, because it was all girls. And, they were pinching and hair pulling and Chinese burns and all these things that used to happen. I felt quite victimised at school. I was bright, but I didn't like the themes. I was protected at home by my grandparents, and I had all this church stuff going on, so I felt that it was sort of like a wild place, you know, with all these wild girls. And early on, I realised I was a champion for the underdog, because there was this poor girl. She was always sick, was vomiting for some reason, and they all used to call her sicky and point their fingers at her. And I remember putting my arm around her and being her friend, because no one else was her friend. And then, of course, you know, they don't like you for that. And in the end, I remember I thought the only way to get these girls sorted is become a leader of a gang like they've got. They were gang leaders, and they were, you know, they were territorial and proprietorial, and they were, you know, they'd wipe the ground clean with branches and put stones around their territory, and then anyone who came near their territory, I can't remember exactly what the rules were, they got punched up or Chinese burned or hair pulled or some dreadful thing. So I decided the only way to get around these people was to become leader of a gang. So I got my own tree and I cleared my own thing, and all of a sudden the girls started coming, and then all of a sudden I had a band of gypsies of my own, and we had a gang.
Did you have a name? Did your gang have a name?
Well, there were two. There was Thornton and Westcarth, the two teams, and I was Westcarth. Westcarth was green. So the Westcarth, what was it? The Westcarth Stars, I think it was. The Westcarth Stars. Because we were, you know, we became the Stars. Because we became sort of more genteel than these other hooligans, you know, Chinese burning and hair pulling. We didn't need to do that. We just glare. And they were scared of us. So that was terrific. So I realised that these lessons now that I learned, you learn them in life when you're very young. And you know when you have to defend yourself, that's the only way you can do. You've got to play it by the rules of the people that you're dealing with. Mm. You know, you have to readjust your roles so that, you know, that was the only way I could get protected, because I was going home with being kicked and bruised and my grandma having to go to these people's places and with me, you know, to tell the mother what that girl did to me that day. It was mortifying, because that made it only worse, you know, sure. The school ground. You know, there's no way you can defend your kids that way, because they just get it worse. So anyway, it was a bit like a battlefield. My childhood was a bit like a battlefield, because there was all this sort of rowing going on, this dysfunction.
You could be forgiven for thinking it was a very violent era, but on the other side of the coin, it really hasn't changed much today, has it? We still get bullying, and we still get... In fact, the violence is probably worse in some ways.
Oh, yeah. It's much worse because it's fueled, you know. It's fueled by much different elements. There was a really good article in yesterday's Sun, I think it was, Les Twentyman, talking about the black boys and the big riots here on the weekend. I don't know if this is dating things, but it was an excellent article. I was reading it and I was thinking, my God, the Sun's improved. They're actually writing a fair spiel. And... yes, it has. It's the bullying's dreadful, and kids are killing themselves. It's absolutely outrageous. So, I mean, I guess, yes, it is as bad as it was, except it's a different set of people.
The other thing that was happening, we're in around the mid-50s to moving on to the 50s. Television happened in Melbourne. Do you remember getting your first television?
I remember the first television that arrived in the street, and the first car that arrived in the street, because you got a ride in it if you were lucky. And the TV, when the TV arrived in the street, in Hartley Street, it was next door to... I lived in Basting Street, which was a main drag opposite the park. Mm-hmm. And then there was a little side street, and there were... the person up the street had this TV, and we watched it arrive on the truck from Myers, I think. You know, Myers used to do deliveries.
Yes.
And the truck came in this great big box, and we all went in. We couldn't believe our eyes. This big thing came in, and then we were all allowed to watch. We were allowed to come up and watch Hopalong Cassidy, and I think Hopalong Cassidy was the main thing.
Here he comes. There's the trumpets, there's the drums. Here he comes, Hopalong Cassidy.
Television would go off at a certain time.
Yes, oh yes.
And there were interludes, a lot of interlude programs, and of course it was black and white, and of course the screen wasn't anywhere near as
big. Oh, tiny, really?
Yeah, tiny screen, a great big box. But yes, it was so exciting, and you were sitting in the room with, because everyone's hormones were starting to happen then.
Yep.
And you were sitting in the room with boys that you wouldn't have even dared walk past in the street, let alone sit in the same room with.
Yeah.
So, it was all going on. It was all going on like that. And it was just such a thrill to go and see Hopalong Cassidy and to go into other people's homes, because we were very, my grandparents kept themselves to themselves, and we didn't have many visitors. I mean, sometimes the ladies would come when my grandmother was making a dress for them. You know, there was a lot of that went on. And she'd tell the story in their teacup while they were waiting. It was just terrific. And I used to watch her, of course. So she used to take me to the spiritualist church, and we used to get readings. My nan used to get readings, the spiritualist church in the Beckett Street. And she used to tell me not to tell anyone at school, because she had powers, not to tell anyone at school because they would further... victimised me.
Yes, of course.
So I learned to keep secrets very early, and I used to love watching my nan read the teacups, because, of course, she wasn't just reading the teacups. She was getting lots of what's it called, channeling. She was channeling, and like women do today, or men, whatever, do today with tarot cards. They use the tarot cards as a prop, but in actual fact, they're possibly getting their information from other sources, ephemeral sources.
By now, we're moving into the 1960s, which were as a fantastic decade. You would have been 14 when the 60s.
Yes. I was still at Bourne High School then.
You were at Bourne High School then.
Yeah. Because
yes.
I went to live with my mother and my stepfather, and that was the deal, that I went to live with my mother and my stepfather when I turned, when I'd finished primary school at Westleigh, and my grandmother, you know, couldn't keep coping with me. I was getting more and more lively. So I went to live with my mother and my stepfather, and that was a different story again, because then I was into the middle class. You know, I'd been in a more or less working class, round the fire, crumpets burning with the, sure, you know, with the fork, and to a modern house that was in a different class. And my stepfather would have visitors from overseas, you know, businessmen, and for meals. And then I was playing a different game, learning to be a different person, like, you know, it's like you have to have different, well, you to survive you have to change the way you are. I mean, I had all my built-in stuff was already there, all my programming was done, you know, with my grandparents, so that has stayed with me, my set of values, my social conscience, it's all stayed with me all my life from those years. Because when I went to live with my mother and my stepfather, the goalposts had really moved. And the name of the game was, it wasn't honesty, really. It was a dishonest, I saw it as a dishonest deal, you know. It was, my stepfather was having an affair with a woman over the road, and it was all sort of undercover, and the arguments that went on with that. Now, you know, none of that stuff happened with Nan and Grandad, because they were sort of, you know, together forever stuff.
Sure.
So then all of a sudden there was this other stuff happening, and of course I was pubescent, and there was a boy next door, and my mother and father always rowing, my mother and stepfather always rowing, so I was drawn to the boy next door, who was a Xavier boy, and there was another disaster because he was a Catholic and I was a Protestant, and then there was all that racism going up again.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
And I went to the... I went to the rower. He was in the first eight, and I loved it because I, you know, all of a sudden you're doing outdoor things, and I'd knitted this Xavier scarf, and he was lovely, my first boyfriend. And anyway, I went to the ball, you know, the rower's ball, and Mannix popped in, for goodness sake.
Is that Archbishop Mannix?
Yeah. And it was most extraordinary that he was there that night. Anyway, I've got a photograph somewhere. I don't know if I've got it of Mannix, but I've certainly got it of the first eight. Of course, I was only 14.
Yes.
And all the other girls were older than me and much more sophisticated. But then I was in a different thing again. And then John went to...
John, that's the boyfriend?
That's the boyfriend. I don't really want to mention his surname.
No, that's fine. No.
Only because, you know, he might be listening because he's an old man.
Well, we should say hello to John anyway.
Hi, John, yeah. Then... we went to live, he went to do architecture at Melbourne University. So then, of course, I got into another scene. I got into the university scene, and I was only 14, 15.
Wow.
So I grew up real quick. I cut a lot of corners. And my stepfather wanted me to be a secretary. Well, I didn't want to be a secretary. And I wanted to go to art school. So I was very strong-willed, and I managed to fail. The shorthand I loved, and I was practically near top of the class for shorthand, but typing, I didn't like it so much, and I made sure I failed it because I didn't want to be a secretary.
Sure.
So I wanted to go to RMIT, and he didn't want me to go to RMIT to do painting. He wanted me to go to Swinburne because Swinburne was commercial art, and that four-year diploma would give me a means to support myself. You know, you got a commercial art job then.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.